Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Give your walls the most advanced protection with Pittsburgh's Paramount Interior Paint and Primer in one. It's scuff, scrub, and wear resistant, while also blocking stains and delivering true one coat coverage. Choose from thousands of color options and refresh your space for spring. View our entire selection of paint and accessories today on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer to find great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by journalist Lizzie Dearden, and we discuss her book, Plotters, that looks at failed terrorist plots in the UK. Hope you find this episode interesting. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Lizzie, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to join me today. So I was wondering, for the benefit of the audience, please could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to cover terrorism cases?
Yeah, so I'm a British journalist and I currently work for the New York Times in London. I specialise in security and crime, which may not come as a surprise given this podcast. But to be honest, terrorism isn't actually something I set out to report on at all. And it was actually a series of absolute coincidences that got me here. When I started my career, it was on local newspapers. And after a couple of other positions, I happened to end up at the Ilford Recorder in East London. And that was in around 2012, which was a really interesting time, because we had Anjem Chowdhury, the leader of the Islamist group Al-Mahajirun, living down the road. Kind of one council area over had the largest population of British National Party councillors of anywhere in the country. There were sort of regular protests. I think just before I got to the Ilford Recorder, there had actually been a bomb threat sent by supporters of the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. So without at all meaning to, I kind of landed in this place where extremism and terrorism, unfortunately, was really part of the kind of social fabric of the local area and a lot of the crime reporting I did. And then in 2014, I moved to The Independent and I arrived a few weeks after ISIS declared its caliphate in Iraq and Syria. So that was the best sort of the biggest story in the world. And I ended up really throwing myself into ISIS's online spaces because I was kind of a similar age to a lot of the people that were being drawn in. I used the internet in a similar way. And so I was able to really deep dive into what they were up to. And since then, I've just stuck with it. But if it wasn't for the Ilford Recorder and if it wasn't for the timing of my kind of arrival at The Independent, things could have been very different.
Yeah, indeed. Well, thank you for sharing that. What was that like, sharing online spaces with ISIS extremists and stuff? Because that must have been quite something.
Yeah, I mean, I was very much a watcher rather than a participant, to be honest. I still am. I found it really interesting. And over time, I broadened that into neo-Nazi spaces, far-right spaces, all kinds of different online sort of social networks and things where people coalesce. And I've always found that even if at the end of the day we can't report precisely what these things are and what people are saying, it's really instructive to see what they're seeing and read what they're reading and to an extent watch what they're watching, to see really where these people are getting their ideas, how they interact with each other, and how it all works, really.
Yeah, brilliant. Now, you wrote a fantastic book called Plotters, which is all about the UK terrorist plots that failed. I was wondering if you could talk to us a bit about why you decided to write that book and how you went about researching it.
Yeah, so I actually used to cover attacks around the world for The Independent, particularly in Europe. So when we had that horrible run of ISIS-inspired attacks from 2014 onwards in the kind of European mainland, I was covering those. And then when the attacks started in the UK in 2017, I was asked to cover that and I became the Home Affairs and Security correspondent, which meant that all of my focus was suddenly on domestic terrorism, as it was called then, which has actually since changed. But I ended up, by virtue of that role, following pretty much every major terror case that happened in this country after 2017. And a lot of those cases related to attacks that were actually stopped. So even before the attacks started in 2017, there had started to be an increase in people charged with an offence called preparing acts of terrorism. Now, that can mean doing something like joining ISIS in Syria, but it can also mean planning a kind of act of terrorism inside the UK. And so alongside covering the attacks that sadly were taking place, I was also covering all of these people. And I basically started to see these patterns where it seemed to me that there were some very strong shared characteristics and pathways between not just the ISIS-inspired attack plotters who were coming into the courts, but also then we saw a large increase in neo-Nazi and far-right attack plotters. And it struck me that there'd been a lot of amazing and in-depth work on terrorism in the UK. But I guess for reasons of kind of necessity, a lot of them had looked at kind of individual movements, individual events. Whereas I found this sort of time period, sort of 2017 onwards, a really interesting time for looking at ideology, but also looking above it and who these people were as people, what they were trying to do and what they had in common.
You chose to focus on failed and foiled terrorist plots rather than successful attacks. Why did you feel this was the most revealing way to understand the reality of modern terrorism in Britain?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that terrorism in most attacks is basically a form of murder. And when you think about murder, which I find useful because it kind of strips everything to its most basic level, I guess, you know, what is the difference between someone who gets stabbed and dies and someone who gets stabbed and survives? You know, the person doing the stabbing probably had the same intention, but there's a whole load of factors that get in the way in the middle and decide if someone lives or not. And in a slightly different way, with terror attacks, traditionally sort of successful or completed attacks have been treated as one thing, and criminal cases have been treated as another, but essentially I see them as pretty much the same pool. You know, all sort of terrorists are the plotters who actually succeeded, and plotters are just terrorists who stopped. So I find it a lot more useful to look at them as kind of one cohort rather than splitting them by what the kind of outcome of their intentions was. And also just by virtue of our criminal justice system and the way things work, you actually can learn a lot more about people who are prosecuted for a plot than people who, of course, may deliberately be killed or kill themselves during the course of a terror attack. I mean, we get inquests and sometimes those can be very detailed. But when someone is, one, alive and secondly goes on trial, the amount of information that the press gets and the public get by virtue of what a jury has shown is amazing. I mean, last week I was in a trial for an alleged neo-Nazi terror plotter where we have a timeline of evidence which is more than 900 lines long. And each one of those lines is a message or a Google search or a picture or anything that this person basically did or said or wrote online and offline. And it really gives you a kind of blow-by-blow account of their lives, which is then added to at the point that they may decide to actually give evidence. Of course, often they lie, but it's still very interesting. And that's a level of detail that you just don't get with many terrorists who actually complete their attacks.
Yeah. What is the atmosphere like in a terrorism case? Because I've not ever been to one. I've been to a murder trial, but I've never been to a terrorism case. Sort of, what's it like sort of watching the accused, etc.?
I think there's a real difference in that sense, whether it's a terrorist who has committed an attack and has killed people and is now on trial because they didn't die themselves, or whether it's a kind of plot where actually this person has not succeeded in harming anyone. Trials after an attack are necessarily very distressing and emotional, particularly because if the charge is murder, as it often is, you know, the most serious charge, although there's often others, you get what they call pathological evidence, where they go through in very graphic detail the injuries that were suffered by people and the way in which they died. And sometimes you get extremely distressing witness evidence and things like that, where, I mean, I've seen jurors kind of break down. I've seen people leave. I've, you know, seen people almost be sick. It's extremely, you know, graphic and distressing. And the atmosphere is just horrible, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's really strange about the plot trials is that actually it can be really boring, like very dry. By and large, with plots, there's not that much emotion in it, because often what the prosecution are trying to prove is, you know, that they sent a particular message, or that they read a particular document, or that a knife they purchased online wasn't actually for cutting steak. As I remember someone once said, you know, it was actually for killing people, or that someone didn't really have a sword because they'd seen YouTube videos of people slicing carpets in like a satisfying way, which is also an excuse I've seen. So they're very different in kind of atmosphere. I would say plot trials are a lot more clinical, and trials for attacks that have been committed can be, you know, very distressing.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. So you framed 2017, which is beginning with the Westminster Bridge attack, as a sort of turning point. So what changed structurally after that moment in terms of the threat Britain was facing?
I think the really strange thing about 2017 was that when the attacks started, and then they started coming very quickly, we had Westminster, then Manchester, then London Bridge, then Finsbury Park, then Parsons Green, all within a year. It felt like a shock to most people, and it was an absolutely awful year, and living in London was extremely surreal as a resident myself. But in the security services, there was a feeling that it was kind of a matter of when, not if. We'd seen all of these attacks in France, in Germany, in other countries in Europe, and there wasn't anything that different about the UK in the sense that there were a lot of ISIS supporters. A lot of them had been now prevented from going to join ISIS in Syria and expressing themselves in that way. It wasn't so easy to obtain guns here like they did for Paris, for example, but there was a strong feeling that something was going to happen, and it did. But what it kind of showed was that the post 9/11 understanding of terrorism and all of the security infrastructure that had been built around that no longer worked, or at least not to the extent it did before, because terrorism, as all of these attacks showed, had shifted from being something that's very networked, hierarchical, involving, often as it did with Al-Qaeda, people who may have had formal training abroad and then travelled back to the UK, people who were extremely ideologically committed, attached to actual groups, acting on some form of instruction, and essentially in networks that the security services would try to infiltrate. All of that was now gone. And you had people who, by and large, were committing attacks on their own or in very small cells of 2, 3, 4 people. And although they were inspired in 2017 mostly by ISIS, they didn't have that foreign fighter training, they didn't have that real-world indoctrination, and the time frame in which people were plotting these attacks collapsed. So all of the methods that were previously in the main successful to stop these attacks no longer worked. And there was a real challenge of, you know, how do we spot these guys? How do we stop them? What do we do now? And that pattern of what the security services call self-initiated terror plots, but what a lot of the public would know as like lone wolf attacks or lone actor attacks, that has been since 2017 the dominant threat to this country and many others.
There's always been a lot of debate around sort of radicalization leading to violence. And I remember certainly around sort of 2015, 2016, it got quite heated, that debate. And then obviously 2017 happened. I was wondering if counterterrorism police's understanding of how quickly people move from radicalization to violence changed after 2017.
Yeah, it changed a lot, I think. And it changed the way not only their understanding shifted, but also the way their operations shifted. The offence I referred to earlier, preparing an act of terrorism, decisions happened which actually meant that people could get prosecuted for committing that offence at an earlier stage, before you would see people get prosecuted at the end of very long-running intelligence operations when they were quite advanced with their planning, you know, maybe having a specific target, having weapons. That's changed now, so it's not uncommon to see people in court for that charge and getting convicted of that charge when they may not have a target, they may not have any time scale, they may not have completed building a bomb or whatever it is they said they wanted to do, because they realized in that post-2017 period that moving from radicalization to attack can be so fast, especially if people are using things like a kitchen knife or a vehicle, which doesn't have to be purchased or made or obtained in any specific way. You know, you can be talking days or weeks rather than months or years.
Yeah. I remember chatting with a former CIA officer about the liquid bomb plot, and he was saying that, like you were just saying, that counterterrorism policing had to leave the arrest to the last possible moment to secure a conviction. And there were still members of that plot who managed to kind of get away with a much lesser charge, because terrorism is quite complicated to prosecute from a legal point of view.
Yeah, and that still happens. It still happens all the time. I can't mention them because I guess it would be kind of defamatory at this point, because they are facing lesser charges. But if you look back at police press releases, you will see a number of people who are arrested on suspicion of preparing an act of terrorism, but may get charged down the line with something like disseminating terrorist manuals. Because when push comes to shove, the Crown Prosecution Service, which makes the decision, says that there's not a strong likelihood of a conviction for the kind of upper level of a plot, but they can prove that, you know, they were doing this or that or the other. So I think when the security services and the police know that a plot is happening, they have a series of decisions balancing kind of the risk of someone actually carrying out what they want to do and then not stopping them in time, against the risk of arresting too early, and then the effect of that interception being less, because the person may only get 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years in prison rather than the life sentence that can result from a kind of terror attack plotting charge.
Yeah. Bit of a left field question. From when you were sort of reporting on these plots, did you ever get a sense that the general public were not really completely aware of the severity of some of these plots? Because I remember back in like the 2015-16 period, a lot of terrorist plots were written off as like being Islamophobia or something from law enforcement's point of view. And I don't know like what comments your articles and things received, and whether you got a kind of sense of how the public perception was of these trials.
I mean, I can't remember getting much commentary, and that's partly because for legal reasons we would turn comments off on the articles. So and I will admit that I don't go seeking responses out on social media in this day and age. I'm sad to say. But even by means of sort of viewing figures, if you can count those as a metric, we would see far less interest in reporting of terror plots than of attacks. And on the one hand, that's so completely understandable. Naturally, the public is more interested and it is more serious if an attack has happened, and especially if people have been killed. And I think with the plots, if there were very straightforward ones that really grabbed attention, there was a guy, for instance, called Naima Zakaria Rahman, who had a very, very particular plot where he was going to go to Downing Street and behead Theresa May, who was then the Prime Minister. that, in a sense, was very easy to report, and that got a lot of attention. It was a very high-profile target, and it was a very specific plot. But I think the cases that are harder to kind of relay to the public and get that kind of attention are the ones where, you know, they considered a synagogue and they considered this place and they considered that place, but there wasn't an exact target. And, you know, they had a crossbow and they had a knife and they were looking at building a bomb. And I think, you know, journalism is all about relaying facts and telling a story. And in my experience, the stories that are the most read and have the most impact are the ones that are the easiest to understand. And some of these plots, particularly now, where ideologies are getting more complicated, people are getting more complicated, and the arrests happen at an earlier stage of the plotting, sometimes they can just be hard to explain to a public in a way that grabs their attention. And, you know, maybe that's our failure.
Yeah. Well, I suppose also you only have so much space to sort of write about it as well. So it is quite hard to give context sometimes, but yeah. Well, many of the individuals you write about were known to the authorities at some point. So how do intelligence services sort of decide who to actively monitor and who to deprioritize from what you've seen?
Well, there is a system of triage within MI5. So MI5, being Britain's domestic intelligence agency, has sort of the headline responsibility for terrorism threats inside this country. Of course, the people who come into contact with this stuff first is often the police. But essentially, however it kind of comes to MI5, they have what are called leads, where if anything is picked up that is considered to be credible, considered to be something that needs to be followed because it could be an issue of national security concern, they will then triage that and decide what to do. And in the sense of deciding what to do, it can range from sort of passing it off to another agency or checking if anyone else knows what's going on, right the way up to launching a full operation where you're putting people under surveillance, you've got covert measures, you might be recording them, you might be sending in undercover role players and deploying kind of every trick in the book to stop that person doing whatever you think that they're trying to do, and also actually to confirm what it is that they're doing. But in each investigation, there are multiple people, and each of those people is called a subject of interest. And what came under a lot of scrutiny and criticism after the 2017 attacks was the fact that there was a very large pool of people who had at some point been a subject of interest and subject to an active investigation, but had ultimately not been considered a threat at that time. And then their cases had been closed, and they were kind of, you know, metaphorically on a shelf somewhere, not really being looked at. And then they reactivated as a threat and they committed attacks. So one of those was the guy who launched the, who was the ringleader of the London Bridge attack, Kurram Butt, also Khalid Massoud, who did the Westminster attack. There was the Manchester attacker who had come on and off and on and off the radar over many years, and had very well-known links to a set of very dangerous ISIS supporters linked to Libya. And so after that process of closing subjects of interest was changed. And as I understand it, there's now a more stringent kind of review process more periodically to check, okay, in 2022, we dropped everything on that guy because he wasn't up to anything, but let's just check what he's up to now.
Yeah. And do you, from your reporting since 2017, do you think that that has had a positive effect?
It's hard to say because this stuff isn't public. This stuff is secret. And the only time as journalists and, you know, by extension as the public, we really get a window into it is when something does really go badly sideways. And there is an inquest in which MI5 is compelled to give evidence. That happened after Manchester. That happened after, most recently, the Southport attack, in which case, actually, MI5 had nothing to do with it. But I guess what I'm trying to say is when something goes wrong, we get these snapshots of information, but those glimpses probably happen every couple of years. They happen in very extreme circumstances. And although when I see things coming through court, I can have a very educated guess as to what cases the security services are involved in and what they would deem a kind of successful operation, that stuff is just not made public.
Let's take a break and be right back with more. In the chapter IS, You Like That, you detail the case of Haroon Syed. What makes his story such a kind of clear illustration of early stage plots and how they develop?
So Haroon Syed would have been, if he'd got away with it, the first ISIS supporter to commit a terror attack in the UK. And he, I would say, was a kind of harbinger, for want of a better word, of a lot of trends we would start to see in both plotters and attackers in the UK. The first thing that was kind of notable about him was that his brother was also an ISIS supporter and had been jailed for planning a kind of Lee Rigby-style attack in the UK. And it's actually a feature of terrorism across the world, but particularly in Europe in the middle of the last decade, that a lot of the most deadly terror cells and terror attacks involved brothers. The sort of Bataclan attacks, the Brussels bombings, I think the attack on Charlie Hebdo. There has been a lot of research done by people a lot smarter than me about sort of radicalization or the enforcement of radicalization within families. And that was something we were seeing. And here's this guy, Haroon Syed. When he was a teenager, his brother got arrested and he started getting very angry at school. His teachers reported him to prevent the counterterrorism scheme, saying that he was starting to voice jihadist ideas. He was starting to talk about Syria. And, you know, they did try to intervene, but unfortunately not before he ended up mounting his own plot to essentially do what his brother couldn't. And he planned a bombing, and he became a kind of case law, actually, because the other thing that his case represented is in the quest to stop him, MI5 and counter-terror police deployed a number of online role players who posed as sort of like-minded ISIS supporters who would be able to assist him in his plot and help him with the things that he needed in order to do what he wanted to do, but of course were in fact recording everything and reporting back. And first of all, his lawyers tried to get the case dismissed as an abusive process. That didn't succeed. He pleaded guilty eventually to preparing an act of terrorism. But then there was also a case at the Court of Appeal, and they were really sort of fighting this point on the defense side, saying, you know, look, he's a teenager. He's having a terrible time. He's obviously thinking some horrible things, but nothing has actually happened. Nothing is sort of real. He's not a real threat. The people he's talking to about bombs are in the security services. He's not ready to do any kind of attack. It's all in his head. And it's not appropriate to prosecute this guy. He should be, you know, helped. This isn't, you know, a terror plot. This is a kind of cry for help. Ultimately, they lost that argument, and a judge found that he wasn't entrapped and that he hadn't been led on by the role players. But that case was really important because the pattern that we saw there, where he was sort of consuming a lot of radical material online, he became an ISIS supporter, he decided to do something. That method of MI5 getting in there in those online spaces actually became the sort of blueprint for a lot of interception of terror plots since. And because Haroon Syed's lawyers lost that case and he did end up getting jailed and everything went ahead, it kind of enabled them to do that going forward.
How many of the sort of failed plot cases sort of involve that style of policing?
This is totally anecdotal, but I would say at least half of the ones that come to court, probably more than half. A much higher number of plots are counted as foiled by the security services and actually end up in court. And again, I don't know, but I would suspect that the ones that end up in court have the hardest evidence. And when you get these role players, what they're essentially doing is recording everything. So they're sort of, I don't know how they do it, whether it's screen grabs or whatever, but anything that the suspects type to them is kept, everything is recorded in a kind of forensic way that can be used in court. And so I think that gives cases a lot stronger prospect of succeeding, and they're probably the ones that tend to get prosecuted. Whereas we've had other cases that have not fallen apart, but resulted in a lesser charge where they maybe weren't on the security services radar. They weren't subject to this kind of operation. There wasn't any role player or anything like that. And actually, it was a kind of public tip-off or something that someone had said to a probation worker or something like that that had tipped people off. So I think this kind of operation happens a lot. But as far as a proportion, there's just a lot we don't know.
Yeah, fair enough. Because I know there's sometimes quite a bit of controversy about sort of quote-unquote entrapment cases, and certainly in the US there's a dim view of them, but I have noticed like the FBI in America do tend to rely on them a lot more than maybe they should. But
my colleagues at the New York Times tell me that there are different rules. Certainly here, what would be understood as the meaning of entrapment is not allowed, but certainly it's debated at a lot of court cases. There was a neo-Nazi plot case that got sentenced last year where persistently through the whole of the trial, the lead plotter was saying, not that he was entrapped exactly, but that everything he was saying in terms of preparing for a race war and preparing to kill Jews and all the rest, that he was only saying it to please this online figure who he was in some way kind of intimidated and scared by. His defense wasn't quite entrapment. It was, I was only saying what I thought he wanted to hear. It wasn't real. I felt kind of pressured by him. And we see that a lot. But so far, I haven't seen it stop a conviction.
Yeah. And if one's cynical, I mean, a guilty person could sort of play that card and hope to get away with things. It's a very murky territory, isn't it? But we won't get too hung up on that. But it's a very interesting sort of area. So one other thing that kind of came out quite in your book is about this sort of gap between the plotter's sort of perceived power and then their actual capability. What does that sort of tell us about them and how they sort of see themselves, these plotters?
By and large, I would say that most terror plotters start out with ambitions that are much larger and more complex and deadlier and sort of not in a positive way, but kind of physically grander than what is possible and what they may end up with. For example, very, very many jihadist plotters in particular start off by wanting to make a bomb. They then discover that that's very difficult, that the, you know, precursor chemicals are now very hard to obtain. They worry that it will put them on a radar. And they may start dining things down to say, you know, screw it, I'll just use a knife and a car. On the far right, we see a lot that people are very often fixated on obtaining firearms, be that sort of having them smuggled into the UK by some kind of contact, getting them through criminal marketplaces, or increasingly manufacturing them using 3D printers. Again, that's very difficult. And certainly if you're trying to get sort of firearms from outside the UK, that has been a technique of the security services that has worked time and again, where you say, you know, you see people in court and it turns out they were arrested at the moment that they were in the car park, that they picked up the bag full of guns, which weren't actually guns because the guy who supplied them was actually a police officer.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole thing was a setup. So I think, I don't know if it's a sort of sense of their own kind of power, but I see it more as part of their sort of wish fulfillment. People who want to commit terror attacks normally want to kill the most amount of people possible, but most of them also want to get the maximum sort of impact, the maximum news coverage, the maximum notoriety. Every terror plotter I've ever seen is always reading up on other attacks, how many people were killed. I've been in a terror trial recently, a guy called Waleed Sadawi. His Facebook profile picture was a guy called Abdelhamid Abaoud, who was the bomb maker in the sort of Brussels attacks, I think. So it's all very self-referential, where all of them have other terrorists that they admire, and a lot of them either want to sort of meet or surpass in some way whatever their predecessors did, whether it's sort of white supremacists looking at the Christchurch mosque attack and wanting to kill even more people or get even more views on their live stream, or whether it's ISIS supporters who want to do another Manchester bombing, but, you know, with an even bigger bomb. But yeah, practicality often gets in the way.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And in some ways, thankfully so. You know, I'm glad it's difficult to make a bomb or obtain a firearm. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a very good thing.
Yes. So how common is the pattern of individuals being stopped from traveling abroad and then turning towards a domestic attack? Is that sort of come up more than a few times in some of these cases?
Yeah, I would say it's not something we're seeing so much now, but that was a real feature of the kind of 2016-17-18 era, where, as we discussed earlier, there had been a slightly outdated understanding of what the threat was. And to be honest, I guess all of these threats were still there. You know, Al-Qaeda is still there. Everything's still there. It's just that no one quite anticipated how fast things were changing and how fast new threats were coming in. So post-ISIS setting up its caliphate in 2014, a lot of the initial efforts by security services all across Europe was actually to stop people going, because ISIS's initial main call to its supporters was, you know, come here, come build our Islamic State, have children, fight for us, come and be part of our project. And 900 people went from the UK. You know, it was serious numbers and they went very quickly.
Yeah.
And so the initial response was, you know, stop these people going, take their passports off them, arrest them for preparing an act of terrorism by going to join ISIS. And a lot of people were. And the kind of flow of people out to Syria dried up quite quickly. And that was viewed as a success. But what wasn't considered perhaps as much as it should have been is what those people would then do, because it created a cohort of what was afterwards labelled frustrated travellers, particularly young men who had wanted to go and, you know, let's be frank, kill in the name of ISIS, couldn't do that, ended up even angrier against the police and the state and Britain for kind of stifling their aspirations. And then since late 2014, ISIS had been saying, you know, option B, if you can't get here, that's fine. Kill people where you are. Kill anyone. You know, if you live in a what they called a crusader country, so Christian countries and or any of the nations that joined the international coalition that was bombing its territories, just go, don't ask for permission, kill anyone you like. And so a very significant proportion of the people who launched attacks in the UK in the name of ISIS had at least at one point considered going to join them, and they couldn't. But that phenomenon really ended by kind of about COVID time. I think the last person off the top of my head that I can remember having considered it is the man who murdered the MP, Sir David Amess. But that sort of travel hasn't really been an option for many years.
Yeah. And do you think the security services would use a technique again should something like that come up, or do you think they would just let them kind of go and then get them when they come back?
I actually spoke to quite a few sort of current and former senior counter-terror officers about this and said basically that, you know, was it the wrong threat balance if you had your time again, or like you said, if it happened again, would you do something differently? And certainly everyone I've spoken to has said no, because letting them go would be kind of Britain's washing its hands of them and say, oh, you know, as a country, we don't care if you go and kill people somewhere else as long as you're not killing us, which would be some pretty harsh realpolitik, I guess.
Yeah.
But I suppose that the police and everyone would say that now they probably consider the impact of measures like that in a more cohesive way. And if the last 10 years have taught people anything, I guess it's what's sometimes called threat displacement, in that you can sometimes address the threat of one course of action and then another one springs up. And I think it's always going to be a hard decision deciding, you know, what's the most immediate one to go for first.
Yeah, it just sort of feels a bit weird. You take away, you strongly feel that somebody's a threat to going abroad, so you take away their passport, but then they're free to kind of commit an act of terror in the UK. Was there a sort of process to sort of deal with some of these people?
Yeah, I mean, again, we only know sort of limited amounts, a lot of it through the inquiries that happened into the 2017 attacks. But a lot of them were subjects of interest. But in the early days, again, they all got closed because, you know, the way they were viewed was, this is a person who wants to be a foreign fighter. He has now been prevented being a foreign fighter. Oh, what's wow. he up to? Oh, he's, you know, back living in his family home. He hasn't got his passport. He hasn't got access to funds. He's back at work. Cool. You know, I think people were put in a box in a way that, hopefully, touch wood, doesn't happen so much anymore.
Let's take a break and be right back with more. Can you talk us through sort of one example where Britain came uncomfortably close to mass casualties?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a few of those incidents, and, you know, can't recommend the book more. They're all detailed in there. But the most recent one that springs to mind was actually in 2023. And this was one of those things I basically couldn't believe myself, really. Ultimately, there was a man who had built a pressure cooker bomb that would have worked, which was twice as powerful as the one used in the Boston Marathon bombings. And he had it at Leeds, St. James's University Hospital in Leeds. He had a whole plan. The plan was that he would send a bomb threat to the hospital where he worked, by the way. And some of this was knitted in with personal grievance. He was going to send a bomb threat. He knew that people would get evacuated in a certain way. He was going to wait at the point where people would muster. And then in the dense crowd, he was going to set off the bomb. And he had absolutely everything ready. He'd really thought everything through. He had kind of various backup plans. So he had the bomb. He also had what was an air gun, but had been painted to really look like a real gun. And he had two knives that he was going to kind of take to his hands, which is a technique that we see basically in the hope of stopping people to get disarmed. So his plan was detonate the bomb, stab as many people as possible, and then make sure that he's killed by brandishing this weapon at the police. And so he texted the bomb threat to one of his colleagues, because he was actually a student nurse at this hospital, and that's how he knew the kind of processes so well. And then he kind of turned up at the hospital and waited with all his stuff completely ready in his car. What he didn't know was that the nurse that he had messaged it to had left work and wasn't looking at her phone. So he's expecting this bomb threat to be called in, the evacuation, you know, everything to happen. And he's just outside the hospital like, what's going on? No one's coming out. What's happening? And he starts sort of moving his car around, walking up and down, sort of getting quite agitated. He's waiting and waiting. It took the nurse several hours to see the text. She did tell the hospital, but then they actually decided not to evacuate the entire hospital. They only evacuated the ward. So the kind of rush that he expected out of the main entrance where he was waiting never happened. And so he's still waiting there, sort of acting, frankly, very suspiciously, sort of pacing up and down, looking very agitated. And then, just by the most insane stroke of kind of chance, there's a guy called Nathan Newby, who is a patient at the hospital, and he's being treated for a lung condition, and he should be in his hospital bed, but he has snuck out to the pub. And of course, if you sneak out of hospital, you have to sneak back in. So it's very, very, very late. It's in the early hours of the morning. this terror plotter. His second name's Farouk. He's kind of pacing up and down outside the hospital, very agitated. Nathan Newby is coming back from the pub. He sees him. And just out of the goodness of his own heart, he just basically asks him what's up. He's like, hey, mate, like, you know, what's going on, basically? And we know this all from the trial that happened next. But initially, Farouk started telling him that he wanted some kind of revenge on the hospital, and he was very agitated. And while they were talking, Nathan Newby noticed his bag at his feet, and he said, oh, what's in the bag? And Farouk says, oh, it's just a bomb. And I mean, I don't know what I would have done in that situation. I don't know what anyone would do in that situation. But what Nathan Newby did was just literally sat on a bench and talked to him for hours. And, you know, Farouk told him everything. He told him what he was planning to do. He said he was waiting for the right time. At this point, he was actually waiting until the hospital opened and it got busy on the inside, and he was going to detonate the bomb in a cafeteria. And he just owned up to everything quite calmly. And this just random member of the public, Nathan Newby, on the way back from the pub, managed to talk him into just handing himself into the police. So suddenly there's this 999 call, and it's Nathan Newby saying, oh, hey, like, I'm just with a guy outside St. James's Hospital. He wants to kill a lot of people, but it's okay. Like, you can come and get him, basically. And they did. He just waited on the bench. He came, and you know, Nathan Newby waited with Farouk the whole time. The police turned up and arrested him.
Wow.
And, you know, it's absolutely astounding. And you know, that random member of the public was actually commended in the end by the judge, and said that, you know, it was him that stopped that attack and absolutely nothing else, because Farouk hadn't been on any kind of security radar at all.
Wow. And I'm surprised. So when the nurse sort of discovered the text message, did she not alert the authorities, or was this happening kind of whilst this conversation was going on? Because that's really fascinating.
The nurse that Farouk sent the message to was called Emily Pritchard, and she had actually been sent the message with the threat at around 11:30 p.m. She didn't see that message until 1 a.m. So that was an hour and a half where Farouk's in the car park just waiting around. At 1 a.m., she called both the hospital and the police, and they were informed of the bomb threat. We're not quite sure what happened at that point, but I think it's fair to assume that from the police side, they had, after the hospital did its initial evacuation and they had their own internal sweep, they didn't have any indication that a bomb was there. They certainly knew, or thought they knew, that one wasn't in the hospital, because in the very specific ward that the threat contained, you know, they'd looked and nothing was there. So at that point, it was being handled as a threat, which is a crime, but obviously not an immediate public safety threat. And of course, it wasn't until around an hour later, when Nathan Newby came across Farouk in the car park, that the chain of events happened that turned out that the threat was actually very real.
Wow, gosh, yeah, so lucky. And, you know, thanks to Nathan for preventing that. My goodness, crazy, isn't it? Absolutely crazy. I think if you wrote that as fiction, you wouldn't believe it, really. But
yeah, no. And I mean, I will say, reporting on terrorism, people often ask me, you know, God, how do you deal with it? Isn't it depressing? And, you know, sometimes yes. But I would say that Nathan Newby is a particularly amazing example. But in almost every, you know, plot and every attack, people, you know, normal people do the most incredible things. And it's always a bit of a silver lining to every kind of cloud to know that for every one sort of terrorist or wannabe terrorist, there's just all these incredible members of the public who do the most amazing selfless things.
Are there sort of warning signs or trends that you think the public should be paying closer attention to?
Yeah, I mean, going back to why I always wanted to write about plots, I think we've seen in the last 10 years that they've really been a forecast of things to come, and often bad things to come. We were having ISIS attack plots before ISIS-related attacks happened. We had neo-Nazi attack plots before we had kind of far-right attacks in this country. I remember someone being jailed for inciting people to commit a Molotov cocktail attack on asylum seekers a year before someone committed a Molotov cocktail attack on asylum seekers. So I think we really need to keep an eye on what's coming through the courts to know what happens next. And really what we've been seeing in the time since I finished writing the most recent edition of the book, which came out in 2024, is what I would call a just complete breakdown in ideological coherence. So we've talked a lot about ISIS, understandably still a massive inspirational force. We've talked about the far right, you know, be they kind of anti-Muslim cultural nationalists or neo-Nazis. They are also still very present, and we've seen a lot of plots in that space come through. But what we're really seeing now coming as a kind of new and growing threat is plots where people are planning violence, but either not for a cause that represents a traditional and well-understood form of terrorism, or sometimes not for a cause that counts as terrorism at all. A couple of years ago, there was a teenager called Jacob Graham who got convicted of preparing acts of terrorism, but he basically just hated the government, he hated society. And when you looked at what he was reading ISIS manuals, he was reading anarchist stuff. He idolized the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski in the US. He was consuming everything and anything, and with what looked like an absolute senseless jumble to most people, to him made perfect sense because he was compiling that into his sort of own individual personalized ideology that gave him a sort of justification for violence. And we're seeing that across the board now. We're seeing basically a complete individualization of terrorism where people are acting for a very sort of unpredictable mix of personal grievances, potentially some mental health issues, scraps of ideology, but nothing really organized. And it makes them very, very, very hard to spot and predict. And if you're looking at traditional ways of kind of de-radicalization, I really have, you know, no idea what that would even look like. And what's potentially even more concerning is that those cases, as long as they have some level of ideology, can still be prosecuted and treated as terrorism. But when you look at the deadliest mass killings that have actually happened in Britain in most recent years, they don't qualify as terrorism. So if you look at the Plymouth shooting or the Southport attack, both of those people consumed extremist material. In Plymouth, Jacob Davison was an incel. In Southport, Axel Ridibarkana consumed a whole range of material, including some jihadist stuff, but mainly a kind of obsession with violence and serial killings and gore. The attacks they committed weren't classed as terrorism. And what that means is if the police had somehow spotted their plans, if they had gone in through the door 2 days before, they wouldn't have been able to prosecute them for a serious offence. And actually what we're seeing now is people come through the courts who are planning mass killings, but get prosecuted in a recent case I saw for burglary.
Oh, wow.
Because if you are planning a mass killing, but it's not for an ideological cause that fits Britain's legal definition of terrorism, which has to be for the purpose of advancing a political, religious, racial, or ideological cause, if you're not in that bracket, and if you're planning alone, and if you're not planning with other people in a conspiracy, which would be conspiracy to murder, at the moment there is no law which fits that crime. And yet we are seeing teenagers obsessed with school shootings, people acting for their own ends, and we're seeing a lot of them. And obviously, we've seen a number of them get through. There was a guy who killed his whole family in Luton and almost committed what he intended to be the world's worst ever school shooting, and again was stopped by pure chance. And I think what we've got to watch for now is, what does the new era of terrorism look like? And is the kind of violence that poses the greatest security threat to the UK still terrorism as we sort of legally understand it, or is it something else? And if it's something else, you know, what is going to be done about it?
Have you seen any sort of signs that there's going to be a change to the definition of terrorism from a legal point of view to help sort of prosecution? Or?
No, there is no, as I understand it, political appetite to change the definition of terrorism. There's also no appetite within the security services to do that, partly from a resourcing perspective. MI5 certainly would say that they've already got kind of far too much on their plate, because not only are they dealing with terrorism, but they're dealing with espionage and what they call hostile state threats, which have completely exploded and sometimes kind of cross over into terrorism, where, for instance, you've got people being paid by Iran to murder people in the UK and, you know, very serious threats like that. So they would say, look, we can't handle everything. But a new law has been proposed by the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation to create a new offence, which would be similar to that preparing an act of terrorism offence, but take away the kind of ideological necessity and replace it with intending a kind of mass killing. The government said it would look at that recommendation. We haven't seen any legislation yet. I'm sure there'll be a debate whether that's laws proportionate, whether it's necessary, but certainly that would be one way of filling this gap.
Lizzie, thank you so much for joining me today. Where can listeners sort of find out more about you, your book, and your journalism?
Well, the book's available at all great retailers. For my current work, I'm at the New York Times, so you can look me up there. And also, I've got a website where I've got an archive of all my work.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for joining me today.
Oh, it's been fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.